It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studio once again, Maria Tomchick, co-editor at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
No no Job this morning again.
No, Job has a little virus, and he's taking a rest.
Yeah, so we want to, he's got a virus, we want to keep him away from us.
That's right.
All right, but still plenty to cover, and thank goodness you're in here to do that.
Yes, let's, I'm here.
Let's don't sound so enthusiastic. let's start out. Washington primaries getting a little bit of media coverage.
Yeah, this week the federal Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, refused to keep alive the state of Washington's blanket primary. We have had an open primary system where it didn't matter whether you were a Republican, a Democrat, an independent, non-affiliated person. You could go in and vote for whichever candidate you wanted. You could vote for a Democrat for one office and a Republican for another office, and so forth. That was changed when the political parties, the Democrat and Republican parties, and the Libertarian Party, got together and sued the state of Washington, saying that that system infringes on their right to choose their own candidates. To reliably choose their own candidates to represent their party at election time for the general election, and it has now been overturned. The U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear an appeal, so now the legislature has to come up. The legislature in Olympia has to come up with a system that would replace the blanket primary. Right now, they're looking at two options. There was a third option they were considering that. I think most people in Washington state would consider too restrictive. You would have to register with a political party. It was called the Arizona system. You would have to register with one of the political parties, and then when you go to vote, you'd have to declare which party you were registered for, and then you would get that party's ballot, and you would only be able to vote for Republican or Democrat or Libertarian, etc. Now, the two plans that they're looking at in the legislature, one is called the top two plan. That one, you would not have to declare a party affiliation. You could vote for anyone on the ballot. And what would happen is that the top two vote getters would then move on to the general election, regardless of their party affiliation. So in some, and some of the people in Olympia say, well, what this means is you would have in most races, you would have two Republicans on the ballot and two Democrats on the ballot, because many, many districts are the vast majority are Republican and the vast majority of voters are Democrat. And so this is not a system that changes the process much. And the political parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, have said that they would challenge that system in court, too, because, again, they say it doesn't address their issues with the open blanket primary that we had before. So it doesn't really give them the power to choose their own candidates, because, of course, anybody, again, can switch over and vote. If you're a Republican, you can switch over and still vote Democrat, etc. Now, the other option on the table that's being considered that does have the backing of the political parties is the modified Montana. It's based on the Montana system with a few modifications. What it would mean is that you could go to the polling place. You could declare yourself either a Democrat, a Republican, a Libertarian, an Independent, or some other party affiliation, and then you would be able to choose which ballot. If you were an independent, you would be able to choose among the various ballots which one you wanted. So you would still only get the ballot of one party and be able to vote for the candidates of a single party. And you would not have to register with one party or another. That's the one thing that they're trying to avoid, that most of the legislators in Olympia are trying to avoid, is the requirement that people would have to sit down and sign up for as a Democrat or as a Republican, et cetera. You could still maintain your independence if you wanted to. However, there are some problems with that. If Now, there are a few things included in the modified Montana system that is supposed to prevent the Democrats and the Republicans from shutting out independents, from keeping them from taking their ballot and voting for their candidates. However, that system still also allows both political parties to, if they don't want to participate in the primary, as it's drawn up under the modified Montana plan, they could just say, well, we're going to have a caucus instead and choose their candidates in that fashion. Now, folks who participated in the Democratic caucuses a couple weeks ago will know that you get a much lower turnout of voters at a caucus, and people who are housebound don't have, you know, perhaps they're housebound because they have to care for children or have an elderly relative or they're disabled or whatever, or they work on the day of, you know, they work on a weekend, they work on the day of the primary or whatever. People who are housebound don't have an opportunity to vote in a caucus system, and that you have to be highly motivated to participate. And in addition, there are some other concerns with the caucus system in that there's a lot of opportunity for influencing people who are not yet decided, et cetera. And some folks view that as a good thing. Other folks view that as a bad thing, depending on your perspective. So there's problems with both systems, really. The top two sounds like it would be great. However, it isn't going to change or provide a lot of variety for voters, and it would still be challenged and probably taken to court by the political parties. And the modified Montana system still would allow the parties to, if they don't like the results, to say, well, we're going to switch to a caucus system, and that would shut out a lot of voters altogether. So that doesn't seem to make a real difference with changing the system either. And there's been a lot of fighting so far in the legislature over the two plans. It's not clear which one's going to be the favored option. And however, because the legislature is going to adjourn on March 11th, they're going to have to decide pretty soon.
Or as they've done with things in the past, maybe they won't.
Maybe they won't decide, and then we'll just have an open, completely open general election.
All right.
That would be fun.
That might be the best thing, from what I've heard so far.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, moving along, other things were happening in the legislature this week.
Yes. In addition to deciding on a new primary system for the state of Washington, the other thing that the legislature has to do this year in this shortened session that's only 60 days this year because it's we have sessions that alternate. We have long sessions alternating with short sessions every other year in the state of Washington. The other thing that they have to do is they have to approve a budget for a modified budget for the biennium, taking into account changes in revenue, et cetera. And this year there's a little bit more money to spend than there was last year. We had a $2 billion hole in the budget that had to be filled and was filled with a lot of cuts to social services. A lot of things that voters had wanted and voted for were not funded, including some improvements in class size, reductions in our schools, and raises for teachers, etc. This year, the governor had said, Governor Gary Locke and the Democrats had said they wanted to redress some of those. Since there was going to be a little bit more money in the budget, they wanted to fund some of those things that got cut last year or that went unfunded. And so Governor Locke proposed a budget that would put more money towards education. Not a lot more money, but some money. And he had proposed, one of the highlights that he had proposed was $42 million going towards assisting students that needed extra tutoring in K through 12 grades, and about $30 million going for higher education so that about 4,000 to 5,000 more students could enroll in higher education in the state of Washington. There are two budget proposals going through the legislature right now. In the House, which is dominated by Democrats, has a Democratic majority, the Democrats have proposed a budget that would pretty much keep intact everything that Governor Locke has added to the budget as far as spending is concerned, it would draw down the state's reserves a bit more than the Republicans would like. In the Senate, where the Republicans dominate, a lot of what Governor Locke wants to, a lot of the spending that Governor Locke wants to add to the budget for this year has been taken out. So the Republicans would only put a couple million dollars towards higher education to fund, you know, a couple hundred enrollments rather than 30 million. And they, in addition, the Republicans want to push more poor people or more low-income people to pay a portion of their Medicaid health insurance premiums, etc. So the things that got cut in the last budget, for example, low-income families who are on the basic health plan have to pay a higher percentage of their health insurance premiums than they have in the past. Those things that, that Governor Locke and the Democrats wanted to roll back and reverse so that poor people don't have to pay as much of that, of their health care, the Republicans are saying, no, poor people should have to do more of that. So that's one of the things that, that the folks down in the legislature are wrangling over in these last few weeks before the end of the session. And it might be worth your while to give a call to your state, to your legislator, and tell them what you think about these two plans, particularly your state senators. Now, another thing that's happening down at the state legislature is that, and we talked about this in the last couple of programs too, about tax cuts that were given to for research and development credits for high-tech companies. Those tax credits will cost the state some $74 million in the next biennium. And that's money that, as you can see, we could use. $74 million is awfully close to that $30 million figure I was talking about for higher ed, plus the $42 million for tutoring for kids in K through 12. Those R&D tax credits could pay for that pretty easily. Now, some folks down in Olympia and a lot of labor union folks in particular are saying it doesn't make sense to give these tax credits without looking at what the impact is, who benefits from them, who actually gets the tax credits. Is it small businesses versus large businesses? And what is the impact? Are there many jobs created specifically because of the tax credits, or does that money simply flow through to corporation shareholders? Now, there's a couple of bills going through the legislature that would look at that. One is called House Bill 1869. It would require performance audits for tax breaks. Now, that bill has passed the House, but it is in the Senate Ways and Means Committee, and it hasn't been scheduled for a hearing yet as of the last time I looked. It might be worthwhile for you to call your senator and talk to him or her about trying to get that bill pushed through the Senate. Now, another House bill that has also passed is House Bill 2654, that would require the governor to prepare a biennial report listing various tax exemptions, who they benefit, and how much they are costing the state. And he would present that every year or every biennium with his biennial budget plan. That I think is a very, very good idea. That has also passed the House, and that's also in the Senate Ways and Means Committee. So that's something else we should keep an eye on, and if you have the urge to call your senator, I urge you to do that. Now, there's a way to get a hold of your senator or find out who that person is, and you can do that on the web by going to www.leg, that's L-E-G, .wa for Washington, .gov, G-O-V. And from that website, you can find information on various aspects of the legislature, and you can find out about bills, and you can also find out who your representatives are.
All right, so call your senators and push them for 1869 and 2684.
2654.
54, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Boy. Okay. Moving along. Anything else on that?
Nope. Let's move on.
Okay. Let's jump over to, speaking of tax breaks, the European Union appears to be a little bit rumpled about some tax breaks.
Yes. Yes. There's a major tax break that the federal government has given to exporting companies that was European Union sued before the World Trade Organization to have this tax break overturned. In the year 2000, the World Trade Organization ruled that the tax break was indeed a violation of the World Trade Organization's laws, and that the European Union would be allowed to impose sanctions. However, the U.S. government, the Congress, in 2002 had amended the law, and had amended the law, and it took until 2002 for the World Trade Organization to review the amendment and declare that that amendment wasn't any change and that the European Union could go ahead with sanctions. Now, the European Union is scheduled to start the sanctions March 1st, so on Monday. Now, this tax break is a tax break for exporters, largely. And the companies that benefit the most from it are the largest exporters, as you would imagine, in the United States, including Boeing and Microsoft, our own homegrown behemoths. Boeing saved some $190 million in the year 2002 from this export tax break, and Microsoft saved something like $89.6 million because of the tax break. Now, you would think that because the European Union is going to levy these enormous fines on these companies, that Congress would do something and change the law. However, we can see that Boeing has a little bit of an advantage in this respect because they have trade partners in the European Union. Boeing put pressure on their trade partners to put pressure on the European Union government in order to exempt Boeing from the sanctions. So one of the two companies here in the U.S. that benefits the most from the export tax break will not have to pay any levies or fines because of the European Union sanctions. Instead, those fines will go toward will be imposed on smaller businesses, the very businesses that the Bush administration says that they really, really want to help the most are the ones that will be punished the most so that Boeing and Microsoft can maintain their enormous tax breaks. I find that highly ironic. Mm. Of course, that some folks would say that that's exactly how the U.S. government operates, benefits for big businesses on the backs of small businesses and the poor.
Well, I can't believe Bill Gates hasn't figured that one out, too, and used some of his leverage.
Well, Microsoft doesn't have as many fans in the European Union at the moment. In fact, there are some lawsuits going on against Microsoft in the European Union having to do with its monopoly practices in the computer industry that didn't get very far here in the United States because the Justice Department doesn't pay much attention to monopoly law anymore. But antitrust law still has some teeth in the European Union. Microsoft is not so popular in Europe as Boeing is.
Both of them are in our local press.
Very true.
Let's. Anything else on that?
No, let's move on.
Okay. How about give us an update on this week in Iraq?
There were two developments in Iraq this week. Folks who have been paying attention to the timeline that the U.S. put in place for the handover of power in Iraq will remember that initially the Governing Council was supposed to come up, the Governing Council being the folks that the U.S. installed as the interim government for Iraq, that the Governing Council was supposed to come up with a timeline of its own for the handover of power in Iraq, initially under the U.N. Security Council resolution that was passed. And because the Governing Council couldn't agree on a timeline, it was Paul Bremer and the U.S. government that imposed a timeline and sat down with the Governing Council and pretty much bludgeoned them into okaying it. Now, under that timeline, an interim constitution was supposed to be drafted and approved by the Governing Council by February 28, 2004. That's today. As of yesterday night, when several Governing Council members finally got up and walked out of the session and they lost a quorum, there was absolutely no agreement on a draft constitution. Some of the things that they're arguing about is, and I'm just going to list some of the major issues that there is a major split on in the council. Kurdish autonomy, that's basically the Kurds want to maintain an autonomous region in the north of Iraq where they get to decide their own laws. They get to keep their Kurdish militias in violation of other laws that the governing council have passed to require other political parties to disband their armed militias. The Kurdish militias want to remain. They want freedom to reject laws passed by the national government, which, of course, the governing council does not like. And they want local control of oil revenue, and they also want the city of Kirkuk, which has not been under Kurdish control throughout the Saddam Hussein era. Kirkuk was not part of the Kurdish Autonomous Region, but the Kurds want to claim it as part of the Kurdish Autonomous Region. Kirkuk is a major oil hub. It's a major oil center, and there are vast oil resources nearby. So this is probably the biggest topic that has split the council. Second biggest topic is the discussion of Sharia law. Should the legal code be based on Islamic religious law? Now, a few of the clerics that the U.S. government had installed on the governing council are saying, yes, it should be based on Sharia law. Most of the other council members are saying, no, you've got to be kidding. This is a secular country. It's been a secular country for decades. We're not going to change that. So that's also another irrevocable split on the council. But there are other topics that they're arguing about, too, such as the role of women in government, the status of women's rights and women's legal status in Iraq, the structure of the interim government to take power on June 30th, what kind of a president should there be, and should it be an expansion of the governing council, and how many members should they add to the governing council, et cetera, and of course there's the all-important question of how those people will be selected to sit on the interim legislature that will govern until elections can take place. So as of last night, there was no agreement, and as usual, the governing council could not come to any decision. And my guess is that Paul Bremer and the U.S. administration will have to impose a draft constitution eventually because of these irreconcilable problems and differences among the various factions on the governing council.
Mm. Paul Bremer's magic wand.
Yes. Well, he does have veto power over anything that the governing council would decide. So if they did sit down and decide that they wanted to impose Sharia law, Paul Bremer has said that he would veto that. So it's a bit ridiculous, a bit of a sideshow, really, that they're doing this discussion at all, because everyone knows that the draft constitution that will be put in place is one that Paul Bremer wants. Now, there is an interesting aside to all this, too. The current draft of the constitution that they're debating was not written by Iraqis. It was written by by Bush administration officials with the assistance of two Iraqi exiles, one of which lives in the Chicago area. He's a trial lawyer. And the other is a man named Salem Chalabi. You might recognize that last name. He's the nephew of Ahmed Chalabi, the Pentagon's favorite guy to become president, a man who was convicted for fraud in Jordan, a man who is a criminal and should not be trusted with holding power in Iraq.
Shouldn't be trusted with holding anything. I understand that Jordan, they want him for $20 million.
Well, I think it's a bit more than that. But Okay. Yeah, he set up a bank in Jordan and then looted it.
All right.
Now, the other topic I want to talk about in Iraq is the election versus the selection process. There's a little update on that. Negotiations on that are moving along, even though negotiations on the draft constitution are not moving along. The U.S. has ditched its caucus plan, as I mentioned last week. Al-Sistani, the Shiite cleric, has accepted that elections can't be held by June 30th. However, he's pushing for December 31st as a deadline for elections, and he wants the U.N. Security Council to sit down and do he wants them to do a resolution that would actually set a date for elections, because he's tired of everybody waffling and saying, well, not yet, not yet, not yet. He doesn't want them postponed indefinitely. He wants a definite date, and he has said that by the end of this year is possible. Now, that's based on the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan and his representative, Lakhdar Brahimi, who went to Iraq and talked to the governing council members and to al-Sistani and some other folks. Those two UN representatives said this last week that elections could be held within a year. So al-Sistani is saying, okay, if they can be held within a year, let's hold them by year's end. Now, Paul Bremer, on the other hand, has said, oh, no, 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 it'll take longer than a year. It'll be 15 months, you know, before elections can be held, which would put them off till mid-2005, which is what the Bush administration, which is what the Bush administration timeline has been all along, is elections in mid to late 2005. Now, right now, there's negotiation going on between those two views. Should it be December 31st? Should it be mid to late 2005? And right now, al-Sistani has given in on the notion of allowing the handover by June 30th. He's pretty much said, well, obviously there's no way we can stop the Bush administration, which is set on handing over the government on June 30th to an interim legislature. There's no way we can stop them from doing that. They're going to do it. However, we want elections as soon as possible after that so that you don't leave the government in the hands of these fools running the governing council. And he has a point. If the Bush administration continues to insist that they have to give power to the governing council, it's going to be a major mess and a nightmare. I think it's going to be George Bush's worst strategic calculation. They want to turn over power by June 30th in order to show that the Bush administration is making progress in Iraq. However, things will deteriorate so badly at that point, I think, that it's going to be a major problem for George Bush come election time, when the governing council will not be able to run the country, and the security situation will worsen, and there will be the potential for civil war.
Well, election versus selection, a problem that we seem to have in this country as well.
Yes.
Briefly, in a minute, could you give us a capsule of what happened with Halliburton this week?
Yes, actually, the Halliburton, as we've been talking about, has been caught by Pentagon auditors and some other folks, including people in the Senate and House. Who have been interviewing Halliburton employees. Halliburton has been caught jacking up the prices for a lot of things in Iraq, and including fuel and some other supplies provided to the U.S. troops there. The Pentagon had decided this week to open up a criminal investigation against Halliburton, finally, on the fuel contract. So that's good news. However, I think they should be opening up a criminal investigation against Halliburton on both of its contracts, not just the fuel contract, but also its contract to provide services to U.S. troops in Iraq, which is, I believe, a much bigger contract, and one that's open-ended, and one in which they're also on record as having made some pretty bad deals and marking things up way up higher than they need to be. So that's some good news, and that's some progress on the front in the Halliburton investigation.
So people should call their representatives and encourage them to pursue that investigation.
Keep the pressure on, because I think the only reason the Pentagon is opening up this investigation is because some senators and representatives in Congress have been interviewing former Halliburton employees and putting pressure on the Pentagon to do something about this.
All right. Well, with that, we are out of time, talking once again with Maria Tomchik, who is co-editor at Eat the State. And Maria, where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, bars, restaurants, various other places where you can find free publications around town. We can also be found on the web at www.eatthestate.org. That's Eat the State, all one word, .org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, or you want to volunteer, you can give us a call at 206-903-9461.